The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab Premium, number 246 for February 25th, 2010. To the second edition of Mac Geek Gab this week. I'm Dave Hamilton here in Durham, New Hampshire. And on the other end is...
John F. Braun in Fairfield, Connecticut. Yeah.
Having trouble remembering where you are?
No, there's a lot of Fairfields. Right, that's true. I'm in Fairfield, Connecticut.
Okay, as far as
I
know.
I see that sometimes in Twitter and stuff, and people are like, you know, this is happening in Fairfield. And I'm like, it is? Oh, my God. Oh.
Different.
Like Fairfield, Alabama. Or Fairfield.
Yeah.
I think every state has one.
Maybe. Maybe we could do a survey and figure out how many states have a Fairfield in the middle.
Durham. I think there's a Durham, North Carolina.
There's a Durham, North Carolina, which is one letter different on the old address there. So very, you know, and that one I think is larger. There's a larger city, so it often confuses people when they're not paying close attention. But anyway, we're not the Postal Service Geek Gab, though maybe we could be. But we won't be. So we have lots of great stuff to go through, and then let's just start, shall we, John? Shall we
dive right in
with let's go with Austin first here.
Hi, John and Dave. Austin here from Easton, Connecticut. You were talking a time or two ago about getting the startup chime to be either loud or soft. The circumstance that particularly interests me is to be able to control it at the time I'm starting it up, not having to make the decision at the time I shut it down. Can you figure a way of doing that? Thanks.
So, John, there's a couple of loaded things here because I know you've got some answers that I'm not privy to yet. We like to, when we do the pre-show prep, sometimes we'll go through exactly what we've found, and other times we just like to surprise each other. So today, John has lots of surprises in store for all of us, folks. So, but on this one, I couldn't come up with an answer here. So my only thought was, well, if you want to mute it, you could take headphones and plug them into the speaker jack. That would, you know, effectively render the speaker, disables the speakers. And then that way you're not, making this sound. So that was my thought on this. And certainly that will work. But, and there
As
is
a matter of fact, Dave, it will not.
It won't?
It will not. I tried it. And actually, Austin is someone that I know. And we talked about this face to face, actually. And I suggested he, and that was my suggestion to him as well. Because
really?
Based on my experience with earlier Macs, if you plug in something into the speaker or headphone jack on the Mac, it'll disable the startup sound. Now, I did extensive...
No, wait. To be fair, it doesn't disable the startup sound, but it...
It reroutes it. You're absolutely correct. It should reroute it.
It does now, on mine.
On your MacBook Pro?
Correct. Same model you have.
And you're not using the preference pane?
What
that silences the starter. Okay, all I'll tell you is what I did. So I went through numerous tests. I tried every startup sound, or I'm sorry, every startup sequence. You know, you hold down. You can do, verbose. Because I absolutely verified. I had my Edimodex plugged into my machine.
Yep. Okay.
I disabled that startup pref pane that disables the sound.
Yep.
And I thought, yeah, of course this is going to work because it's done this on other Macs.
Right.
It did not.
Maybe
it
doesn't
absolutely, on mine. They were absolutely plugged in. And when I restarted the machine, it made the chime.
Through the speakers, but not through the earphones.
Yes, that is correct.
You know, I've always just assumed, because I have speakers plugged into my MacBook Pro, I've always just assumed that the startup sound comes out of the bigger speakers as opposed to the little ones in the MacBook Pro. But I've never challenged that. So it's possible that I've been living with a false assumption based on previous Mac's behavior. So is there an answer here? I guess is the question, John.
The only without running a piece of software that fiddles around with something in the system and the pref pane.
Hold on.
Startup. Yeah, it's called startup sound. I found no way. If I disabled that, I found no way. I tried every startup key that you could imagine. C, D, Command V for verbose, Command S, Shift, which and none of those changed the fact that it makes that startup sound as soon as the machine starts up.
Interesting.
I went online. I looked. Now, some people even suggested, and while it's true this worked on prior machines, like I found one that I thought, this is going to work, is on earlier machines, the Motorola machines, if you held down the mute button,
okay,
that would mute it. It did not on my MacBook. I did both the mute button, which is F9, I think it is, or...
Whatever it is on your particular keyboard.
Or F10, and I even did function F10. I tried everything. So this is like an uber geek challenge.
Huh.
If anybody knows a way, short of ripping out, reburning the firmware or cutting the wires, I tried everything.
Okay,
I thought,
so
maybe there's one key combo.
Yeah.
Maybe there's a secret one that does that, but I tried all the published known, startup modifiers that will make your Mac, start up in different ways for various reasons. And every one of them did the chime, even with earphones or headphones plugged into the speaker jack. So I'm afraid, I exhausted everything that I knew. And based on what I saw online, there are a number of people that are really aggravated by this because then the response was, from the, I'll say the fanboys or fangirls. Well, of course you want to hear this sound because why do you need to restart your machine? Because the sound does do something useful, and then it does let you know that the machine has passed at least a rudimentary,
yes,
what they call post or power on self-test.
Yeah.
And maybe
yeah.
Apple doesn't want you to disable that. They decide that it's in your best interest not to turn that off.
Now, but you can using the thing from Arcana Research, right? The startup sound prep pane, the third-party startup sound prep pane, that will disable it, right? Okay.
That does it because, and I got to dig into what that is doing, but I don't know if there's a way to get it to do what it's doing
ahead of time.
Ahead of time.
Or in real time, I guess. Ahead of time is what it is doing, right? It's doing something. So, yeah, I wonder, okay, so let's, and I'm going to make an assumption here that whatever Arcana Research is doing with this startup sound prep pane can be done from the command line. Right. They're writing something to PRAM or NVRAM, and there is a way to do that at the command line. Although I guess either way, I was going to say you go into single user mode and issue the same command, but all of that happens after the post, the power on self-test.
I do believe what they're doing, but we'll look into it more. But I believe what they're doing is something in the P. I think it's a setting in the PRAM.
OK. Yeah. But which would make sense. Sure.
But you can't get to it until after you hear a startup chime.
Yeah.
So, Austin, I'm afraid there is no way to do this unless you start up your machine at least once and hear the chime.
Yeah.
It is annoying, though, because if you're in a, if you're, people are sleeping or if you're in a classroom or something like that and you don't know about this pref pane, then it is a hassle. I mean, I suppose you could try to cover the speakers up.
Or cough really loud, or like I get some of those little poppets. You buy them around the 4th of July. The little they're like gunpowder wrapped in white paper, and they look like, well, frankly, they look like little sperm cells. But actually, they look like very, 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 very large sperm cells. But you take them and you throw them on the ground, and they make a very loud sound. So what you do is you get a handful of those and you throw them to the other side of the room at the moment that your Mac's going to start up, and then nobody will notice that your Mac made any noise. That's
yeah, the other way is once you start your machine, I think if you lower the volume.
Wait,
to zero,
love on that suggestion, John? I mean, that's creative, like out of the box thinking right there. No love.
I like it, but there's liability concerns there. I mean, what if you hit somebody or but I don't agree with them forcing that behavior. And as I mentioned, from what I recall on the Motorola Max, if you held down the mute button during startup, you can hold the machine. All right, just this once. Don't make that noise, and it would honor that.
Yeah. Huh. All right.
So
let's move on to Jim. This was another interesting one that I think you're going to surprise me on, John.
Hey guys, Jim from Cincinnati here again with a follow up to my question I sent you.
Oh, that's right. I was going to stop this. Jim did send in two questions or two audio files for the same question. The first one was very, very long. And then this one sort of explains it. What he's done is he's got PDFs that he's annotating. Now he's creating these PDFs using Adobe's Acrobat ClearScan technology, which is actually pretty cool. It takes books and turns them into font-based PDFs so that they're very small and he can cart them around on his laptop. But as it turns out, Jim's issue isn't related to how he's creating the PDFs. It's something else. So the issue is that he is unable to do text search, but he'll explain.
Hey guys, Jim from Cincinnati here again, with a follow-up to my question I sent you yesterday. I did some more testing last night, and I think I found what the problem is, but I still don't have a solution. So as I said, I create these files, these clear scanned OCR PDFs in Acrobat, and I go and I read them and I annotate them in Preview. And that's my preferred app to use. I like Preview for reading them over Acrobat. And I use Snow Leopard has great annotation tools in Preview. You can highlight and draw boxes and you know, outline the text, take notes and everything. It's great for taking notes on text PDFs. So what I did is I found out if I scan the file and I put it on my MacBook and I don't annotate it with Preview, it's searchable and it works like it should. And this is probably why I was encountering some documents that were working, because I had not annotated them yet. If I go into Acrobat on my MacBook and I annotate it using Acrobat's highlighting and text annotation tools, and then I save it, it still works in Acrobat. And in Preview, the text is still searchable and everything's great. If I use Preview to annotate it at all, highlighting it or anything, I save it. As soon as I save it, it then no longer works in Acrobat or in Preview. And that is where my problem is. And I was able to repeat this a couple of times to make sure that's what it was. So Preview is somehow, when I'm using the annotation tools, is somehow changing the PDF so that the font and the text behind it is not there anymore or is corrupted or something's going on, and it's reproducible. I did it several times, like I said. So if anybody can tell me, one of you guys or somebody in the audience, what is going on here and how I can fix that, that'd be great. Thanks a lot.
You bet. Okay, so again, I'll start and know that John has a better answer, but you know, my I tested this, right, John? And I found a PDF and I annotated it. You know, it was a PDF created with something else. I annotated it in Preview, saved it, brought it back in. I did highlighting annotations and link in Preview. So I created a URL that I could click to, and the annotation stayed and I was able to search and the search worked fine. But you tried the same thing, John, and you had exactly the same experience that
yes I did, because I
sorry about that. So you tried it, John, and you had the same problem, the same experience that Jim is. You didn't use ClearScan, you just took another PDF and did this and had the same problem. You couldn't search, is that right?
Yeah, because I thought it was weird, because you said, you know, you took one, you tried it, and I'm like, well, you know, that's good enough for me, I'll go to the next question. I'm like, you know what, let me try it just for kicks, just see what happens. So I took a PDF that had OCR ability, opened up an Acrobat, tried to search for a word. I was able to find it, brought it into Preview, annotated it. You know, I think I highlighted something, and then I brought it back into Acrobat and I typed a word that worked before and it didn't work. And I'm like, what? That makes absolutely no sense. Then I went to document. I'm like, you know, I wonder if it changed it maybe from, you know, text to a bitmap or something like that. But that wasn't the case, because I was actually able to go into the document and highlight some text.
Okay.
Like, okay, that's weird. So it doesn't think it's a graphic. It still thinks there's text in here. Here's what started to lead me down the path.
Is there some index that goes away or something?
No.
Okay.
No. So I highlighted the text, a portion of the text, and then I opened up another program. I think it was a text edit. And I did a paste.
Yeah.
I got all little squares. Weird looking characters. Then I'm like, you know what I think's happening? I think it's maybe doing a Unicode translation. It's writing it out as a double byte character set, because it pasted the text, but it didn't look right.
Huh.
It didn't paste the same text. Now, even better, here's more investigation I did. So then I opened up Microsoft Word.
Yeah.
And I pasted the text. Now, I think Microsoft Word understands Unicode because the text appeared as I had pasted it, as I had copied it. But when I tried to do a find on a word, that also failed. So at least in Word, I think Word has a, has an ability to understand Unicode or you know, double word fonts that some of the other programs shouldn't, because, you know, at least our alphabet, we don't use double byte character sets. We don't need to. Then I'm like, what is behind this? Because then I open another document and it worked just as it worked with you. So here's the thing. What was the difference between the two? And I think I zoomed in on it.
What was the difference?
Here's the difference. So when I opened up the document where after preview dealt with it, things got corrupted. I then opened it up in Acrobat Reader and I went to document properties and I looked at the fonts. And there were two fonts in the document that I had. Arial with a little TT, which is true type.
Right.
Embedded subset and Arial bold embedded subset. Also a true type font.
Okay.
Then I took the document where it did work and I did the same thing in Acrobat Reader and looked at the font. It was a PostScript font. Here's my speculation. And actually, I kind of confirmed this because I looked and did find an Apple discussion thread about this. As far as I can tell, this is a bug in preview. It may not be true type fonts, but it may be a particular. It's definitely a font issue.
Okay.
Because with this true type font, when preview tried to write it out, and other people commented on this as well, they were basically saying, if I read it in once, or as soon as I write it out, it's corrupted, and I can never find the text again. So I think there's a subtle bug with maybe this specific TrueType font or TrueType fonts in general, that preview writes it out for whatever reason as a double byte or a different font
yeah.
that the programs then don't understand because the mismatch.
My guess is they do understand it. They just you're not searching for the same characters that it has, right? I mean, if you were searching for double byte characters, I'm sure it would find them just fine.
Yeah. The funny thing was, again, in Word, when I pasted the text in, I could read it. It was in English, but if I tried to find a word that was right in front of me, it failed.
Oh, that's so interesting.
So this is I think it's a single double byte font true type, but it's
okay, so
definitely
let me,
preview.
Let me ask you this. So preview is causing this by doing the annotations or really any changes that force preview to rewrite this file out, right?
When the document has, at least in my experience, when the document had a true type font embedded in it.
And then preview can no longer search in the document. Have you tried searching from Acrobat? Does Acrobat still search okay?
No.
Okay, so it's broken the PDF. It's not just a bug localized to preview. Okay.
Once preview has written this out, nobody, even though it still is text and you can cut and paste it, well, though when you paste it in certain programs, it makes no sense.
Yep.
It's gibberish. Once preview's done that once, you're finished. Your OCR is done. And I even tried.
And how about annotating or editing with PDF Pen?
Well, you know, it's funny because I actually, you know, I knew you'd ask that. See, I'm telling you, man, I
wow.
I did my homework here.
I didn't think, wow.
Because I was like, you know, maybe something's weird here. So I tried to pull the document into PDF Pen and it wouldn't offer to OCR it because the thing was, it was already text.
Well, yeah, you
this
wouldn't.
Is, well, this is the part I was taking where I thought it maybe had translated it from text to bitmaps.
I see.
And I thought, oh, well, PDF Pen will just.
No, I mean,
know,
what if you skip the OCR? I mean, you've already got the text in there, right? He's already got the text from ClearScan. He's not having preview do any of the OCR. He's just dealing with the document.
Yes.
My question is, if you just open that same PDF in PDF Pen and do your annotations there instead of in preview, will PDF Pen write them out properly? And I think it will because I do most of my annotating of PDFs with PDF Pen and I'm still able to search in them after I do it.
I did not try that. So
okay.
Yeah, okay. So try that. So I suspect PDF Pen, yeah, it'll do it properly. It doesn't corrupt the font, but preview has this subtle bug that does. So,
very interesting.
Actually, you know, we got to get on the horn or, you know, Phil, if you're listening or someone, you know, can you help us?
Yeah. Interesting. Interesting.
Man, that was a toughie because at first I'm like, what is going on? Why is it kind of corrupting it, but not really?
Right. Cool. All right.
So I would encourage him, try to find out, look at the fonts in Reader. look at the fonts embedded in there. And I'd like actually to get Jim's feedback. I'd like to see if there's a trend as to what font, either style or
kind.
In this case, it was Arial TrueType. I'd be interested. Jim, please let us
know. Yeah, because it might just be if Jim changes the font to something that's more, you know, that's more compatible with the bug that exists in preview, then maybe his life is totally fine. Yeah. Cool. All right. Moving on to Marion. Marion writes, in an older show, you mentioned that the way POP3 email works is that it downloads emails to one place and that's it. Well, my company email accounts are definitely all POP3, and all the incoming messages download both to my Mac and to my iPhone. Of course, there's no syncing, so when I read a message on one device, I have to manually mark it as read on the other as well. Nevertheless, just thought I'd ask how this actually works. And in a nutshell, POP3 is built as a download-only email protocol, essentially. Mm-hmm. After downloading your email, then the client then has the option as to whether or not it leaves that message up on the server, right? So most of the time, default behavior of most POP clients is that it's going to delete from the server either immediately or after some period of time. Maybe.
Right.
All right. So it deletes it from the server, either, like I said, either immediately, after a week, after, you know, some period of time. But you can set it to stay out there manually and only be deleted when you tell it to delete from the server. Now, you have to be careful with that because if you know, chances are you've got some accounting happening on the server where it, you know, you've got some maximum size that your email can take up it. And then after that, it starts bouncing things. But that's how what you're doing here, Marion, works, is that both of your email clients are, at least for some period of time, leaving all the mail on the server so that other clients can get them. There is a caveat here, though, that sometimes the server will renumber the messages that are out there. If you go and if one client does a bunch of deletes, the other one might think, oh, hey, all these messages that I see are new, when in fact they're not. And you wind up downloading duplicate messages. And that happens a lot with POP, especially when you've got multiple clients managing the same account. And frankly, that's why IMAP is better for this solution, because IMAP is a protocol that has all your mail stored on the server and then all the clients just syncing with it. So it's built to be more of a two-way kind of cloud client server setup with IMAP rather than POP. So that's why that works. But again, if you can, I highly recommend going with IMAP. And although it's not perfect, a free option for IMAP these days is Gmail. So it works fairly well. It's a little quirky in terms of the way they do some things in it. And you may still have some of that message duplication because Gmail doesn't really use folders. But they had to kind of approximate that for their IMAP implementation. But it's free, so you get what you pay for. And MobileMe is IMAP as well. So, but you're paying for that.
Yeah, I've been changing my email setup here. And actually, I did migrate my MobileMe over to that, because Eudora does talk IMAP.
Right.
Interestingly enough, it creates a different inbox. It doesn't put it in my universal inbox where everybody else, all the other mail gets dumped. And just to add to what you said, Dave, so here's a little detail, and everything you said, I think I'm
yet again with the audio. Okay, we're back in, John.
Okay, so pretty much I'm with what you said there. I have one little caveat.
Sorry about that. That was a good for a laugh, though. John, whatever I changed on the audio interface to reset it had you sounding like you were half an octave or an octave lower. It was actually pretty interesting. But we've got you back to normal now. So please continue.
Okay. So quickly, I just want to describe POP and where I think a problem may introduce itself, and then a little security or kind of a security tip. So okay. POP is RFC 1939, and we'll link to that. And the basic commands that you need, and actually, if you want to mess with this from the command line, you can do this. If you start up the terminal and do telnet, and then the name of your POP server, which would probably be pop.something.com, space 110, because that's the standard port that POP lives on, there are a number of commands that you can issue. Now, the first command, and I'll talk about this last, is when you log in. And normally you give your username and password. Though there's a different thing to do, and I'll talk about that at the end. Then there's a really basic set of commands that you use to find out what's happening. The first one is called list. Here's what list does. When you say list, the server's going to list all of the messages that it has for you. And it's going to list two pieces of information. One is going to be an ID starting with 1, which is going to be, okay, this is message 1. And then there's going to be a number after that, which is should be a unique ID, which is what you were talking about, Dave.
Right.
The next command is...
Well, and to be fair, that ID will always be unique as far as the server's concerned. But
should be unique, yes.
Yeah, but...
It should never repeat itself. Well, it should always be increasing, one would think, for a particular account.
Right, but oftentimes with POP, it resets back to 1, which stinks. That's what I saw.
I mean, the other thing that I'll think, and then I'll move on, is that the client sometimes, I think, keeps track of that ID.
Yes.
So and if the client is somehow interrupted or corrupted or something, and its opinion of what is new and old is different from the server, then it may either, and I've seen this happen actually, right, with my POP account. This is where you may want to actually go into your POP account and do a list and see if there's anything there. Because I've seen it in cases, and I think it's because Eudora or whatever mail I was running crashed. I did a list, even though my mail client said there's nothing there, when I did a list, there were messages there. And then the other command, so the other is RETR. If you type RETR space and the message number, like 1, it'll show you the text of that message. That doesn't delete it. What you got to do is actually say DELE. That deletes a message. And that's what the POP, and that's what your email program is doing in roughly this order. So it says, all right, first log in, list all the messages, retrieve the messages, then maybe not now, maybe later, because it depends on how you set up your mail program, delete the messages, and then you get off of the server. So that's the mechanics of it. So yeah, I think we're pretty much in agreement of how the whole thing works.
Got it.
The renumbering thing I've never heard of, though, where the server renumbers things, and that's bad because, you know, the number should never, you know, they should always be increasing.
Yeah. Happens all the time, especially when people start having multiple POP clients pulling from the same server. I can't tell you how many times I saw that back in the consulting days. It was just it was rampant. Yeah,
got it. Now here's the cool part. So I've been upgrading my setup here, and you know, in addition to moving over to IMAP, I was checking out some of my email clients, and one of them I was using with a basic username and password, which is not terribly secure. As a matter of fact, it's not secure at all.
There's nothing about it that's secure. That's right.
No, I mean, the only thing is that, you know, my wireless traffic is encrypted, and I assume people are not, you know, watching. But
I'm watching.
If they were, I've changed the way I log in to prevent people from at least grabbing my username and password. And how do you do that? There's something called APOP.
Okay.
And this is a different way of logging in. So normally, the basic POP is username and password. And actually,
right, that's totally sent in clear text. If you're connecting with standard POP over port 110, it is, you know, 100% clear text username and password.
Right. Without using a secure tunnel or SSL or something like that, which I suppose you could layer on it somehow, but normally you don't. Yeah. So you're absolutely right. APOP is a little better because here's what APOP does. So rather than a username and password, and actually if you telnet, you can type this. You type user space your username, and then it'll say, all right, what's your password? You type pass space and your password, and you're in.
Okay.
APOP, you do it a little differently. So on a single line, what you do is you type in your account name, and then following that, you type in not your password, but something called a message digest. And you may have heard of these things like SHA-1 and MD5 and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And in brief, there's something called one-way functions.
Okay.
What you need is a piece of information other than your password to combine with the password. And then you apply this, and it's something that's incomprehensible. And the cool thing about it, so here's the data that's into that, and then we'll move on. But I thought this was pretty interesting how this is done. Now you may think, gosh, I'll just, you know, type in the username and then this message digest, and I'm in. I'll just copy that. Well, the thing is, you can't, because here's what constitutes that other piece of data, what they call a shared secret. So when you log into the mail server, it will create a big glob of data, which includes the current process ID of the email process. Okay, that's something that's hard to guess, but not impossible. A timestamp, and then the host name, and it lumps all that together. Now, here's the interesting part. You're probably, the thing is, this prevents what they call a replay attack. The thing is, if you see what someone sent one time, and you try to do it again, because the either the process ID or the clock is different, you're not going to be able to come up with the same value.
Oh,
get where
right.
I'm going with this?
Yep, I do.
So
sure.
It's a pretty
yeah.
clever way. So unless you can guess the process ID and the clock and the person's password and create this unique message digest, you're not going to be able to get into their account. So it's a better way of getting into the mail server than username password. And I actually switched over my Eudora to that, and it works fine. The server supports that protocol, so that's nice. So
oh,
if you
good.
Have that option in your mail, you know, rather than username and password, it's a little better. You know, it's still better to get an SSL connection.
I was going to say, can't you? Wouldn't SSL be the preference here to secure either IMAP or POP?
Absolutely.
Okay.
The problem is my provider does not offer that because I enabled that. I enabled SSL, and it gets kind of squirrely because there's different ports and stuff.
I was going to say, from what I remember, Eudora's implementation of SSL was only like half-baked.
Oh, no, it's fine. No, they have a number of options. The problem is when I enable it, I get a message back from my mail server saying, you asked for SSL, and I'm not giving it to you because I can't do that.
Oh,
go away.
Okay, fair enough.
No, Eudora works with Gmail and .Mac using SSL. It works perfectly fine. So their implementation is okay. They have a number of options. You know, you can use legacy SSL or TLS, which is something newer.
Yep.
So you may have to fiddle with it in the port numbers, but Eudora supports that fine. The problem is my provider just, you know, Optimal Online just doesn't do anything except basic unencrypted POP.
Okay.
It's really too bad.
That is too bad.
So I just want to add that caveat because I thought it was an interesting addition.
Yeah, that's it.
Now we got and speaking of mail, Dave.
Speaking
so I think
of
we're
mail.
Done with that, right?
We are done. Oh yeah. We're done.
Way
that's
done.
Good.
Okay.
Way
we got
done.
Matthew, and Matthew has a cool tip.
Yeah. So Matthew writes, and I'm trying to think. He says, "I have." I'm trying to think of where to go with this. He says, "I have spam sieve set up." He's talking about spam filtering and this issue of, you know, we have. For years, we've had mail on our Macs, and so we figured out how to filter spam there, right? We run some third-party software, or maybe not third-party, right? Apple's mail has its own junk mail filtering that, it works fairly well. And then there's some third-party alternatives. There's spam. SpamSieve is the most popular, but there's certainly others. But the problem is none of those run on your iPhone. So what do you do? You know, certainly you could, if you're using IMAP, you could have the spam client on your Mac pull the mail out from the mail folder, and then it doesn't appear on your iPhone. But what happens if your Mac isn't running? So here is what Matthew says. Matthew says, "I have a SpamSieve installed on my headless Mac Mini at home, which is the master for my email. It is then possible to set up drones by creating folders on the IMAP account called Train Good and Train Spam, and running a little Apple script. So I have an iPhone, too many Macs, and one copy of SpamSieve running on my Mac Mini. The rest of my computers, and of course my iPhone, don't run SpamSieve. It's only running in this one place. When I'm on the road, my Mac Mini is doing all the spam filtering, and all my other Macs reflect what the Mac Mini has done because it's updating these changes to the IMAP server. Well then, if I see a piece of spam, either on my iPhone or one of my other Macs, that has not been caught by SpamSieve on my Mac Mini, I move the spam email into my Train Spam folder, which is a folder on the IMAP server, which then appears in my Train Spam folder on the Mac Mini because of the magic of IMAP, upon which a rule runs and an Apple script, and boom, it's trained. Likewise, if I get a false negative on my iPhone because SpamSieve's got it wrong, I move that to the Train Good, and again, I'm away." And he's given us a link to the Apple scripts, the little drone Apple scripts that sit there and do this training for him. And this is actually a fairly simple thing to set up. You create these extra folders on the IMAP server, and then you've got this going. And it very, very similar to what I use here. We have a server-side spam filtering solution that runs on the mail server, but it's doing essentially the same thing. We have to use a Train Good and a Train Bad folder. Essentially, there's three spam folders. There's the place where it sends things that it thinks are spam. So in his case, SpamSieve. In our case, it's D-spam on the server. Then we have the Train Good and the Train Bad, just like he does. And we put things there, and then they magically disappear. So and disappear and train the software. So very cool. Thank you, Matthew. This is a good solution. We've got a link that we'll put in the show notes, and of course Michael Johnston will put it right here, and we'll take it from there. So you got anything to add to that, John, or are we moving on?
No, that's very clever.
Yeah.
I like it.
It's good. I never thought about doing it with, you know, with a Mac doing that job, but it doesn't matter. I mean, it's all the same. It's, you know, six of one, half a dozen the other. And that way you can use SpamSieve, and you've got a nice graphical interface to train it and mess with it.
I got to say, I love SpamSieve, man. When I look at the stuff that it grabs and throws in my junk folder, I mean, these guys, you know, they do clever misspellings and replace numbers with letters and letters with numbers, and it gets it almost all. Almost all, every now and then, and you know, as he suggests, you know, you can give it a little hint, saying, you missed this one, because sometimes it's hard to tell. But the ones that you know, all the little tricks that they used to use, but this thing is way smarter than they are. So
yeah, awesome. So thank you very much, Matthew. That's good advice here. All right, let's move on to Bob's audio comment.
Hey, John and Dave, it's Bob from Marquette, Michigan. I'm using a MacBook, and I'm running OS 10.6.2. I'm having some problems with Safari 404. It's just started in the last 3 or 4 weeks, where if I click a link in email to go to a web page, or if I open a second window, browser window, there's no toolbar, and I have to go into the View menu and choose Show Toolbar. It doesn't happen every time, but it happens about half the time, half to three quarters of the time. And I tried dumping Safari's preferences. That didn't do any good. I've rebuilt permissions. Can't figure this one out. If you can offer me any help, I'd appreciate it. Thanks.
All right. So this is interesting. In theory, you would think that dumping the prefs would have wiped this out, but obviously something's causing it to continue to happen. The first thing I would do is to look for any new or updated Safari plugins that are installed on your computer. And those are installed in the main hard drive library / internet plugins, and also in the home folder library and internet plugins. The other thing to check and look in there and take a look and see if there's anything there. Another place to check is the same two, you know, either library or home library and input managers. And there's a piece of third party software that's old, but it works, called Diablotin, D-I-A-B-L-O-T-I-N. It's available for free. Hasn't been updated in about 3 years, but it works. And it's essentially like remember the old extensions manager in macOS 9, where you had the ability to turn things on and off, and all it did was move it into or out of a folder. So you weren't deleting anything, but you were able to manage. And Diablotin will let you manage your internet plugins as well as your input managers and turn them on and off very quickly without deleting them. So you can do some testing. And that's where I would start. Turn off those, see if it comes back.
Browser?
No, turning them off in Diablotin, right? You quit Safari.
No, but you're saying browser plugins.
Browser, internet plugins, yes.
Okay, no, there's another program that I found called Plugin Cool.
Okay.
That has a web browser section as well, and I think this is a slightly newer program.
Oh, I'll have to check
this
out.
But I think
it
does something pretty similar. I mean, it shows each plugin. I'm looking here, RealPlayer, Picasa, Google, and Silverlight, blah, blah, blah. And it has a little check mark. So similar, but yeah, I think it's slightly newer, so I thought I'd mention that.
Ooh.
Plugin Cool.
Oh, I'll have to check that out. That sounds like that might have taken over for Diablotin here, which is an old standby that I use for these things, but that's great. And then, you know, some of these plugins, remember, Safari might be running in 64-bit mode, and you might have a plugin that was written for 32-bit. Now, in theory, that would just disable the plugin because the plugin wouldn't load. But you could also try running Safari in 32-bit mode, and you do that by quitting Safari, go into the Finder Applications, highlight Safari, and choose a Get Info, and then check the little box that says Open in 32-bit mode, and see if that helps. I'm not sure about that one, but there was some Apple discussions about that happening, so I figured I'd mention it. But really, I think it's probably a plugin. I can't imagine what else it would be. You got any other thoughts, John?
No, I'm with you. I've seen plugins fight with each other. Silverlight, I've seen. Mess up some other, animation and display.
Right.
Plugin. So.
Okay, are we ready to move on to Steve here?
Oh, you're gonna love the thing I got for this.
I think Steve's gonna love the thing you've got because okay, so here's the deal. Steve wrote, "I have a Mac Mini connected to my TV solely for watching video in my main IMAX in a separate room." My main Mac has my video stored on it, and I have set the Mac Mini to mount the drive from my main Mac at startup by dragging the mounted network drive into my login items. I do video through Plex, which also opens at login. So far, so good, and the setup works great. The problem arises if I reboot my main Mac because the Mini loses the network share. I have to manually remount the share or reboot the Mac Mini. None of these options are great because A, I don't want to have a keyboard and mouse permanently attached to the Mini, and B, I would like peace without my better half shouting up the stairs at me because a movie won't play. I totally get this. You want the living room, and I'm like this. I have a lot of technology in my living room, but I have my tolerance for faults there or for any sort of errors is like zero. And that's not just because I'm tech support for the family. It's because when I'm in the living room watching TV, that's my downtime. I don't want to have to be troubleshooting all this crap. And that's why Netflix streaming drives me crazy. But for another time, back to Steve. What I'm looking for is either a better way of mounting the drive that will reconnect it when it becomes available again after a reboot, or a nice third-party app that will notice a lost share and do the mounting for me automatically once the drive is again available. Trying to solve that last issue, I found Reconnector X, but it doesn't look as though it's actively updated anymore. Do you have any suggestions? Okay, so the thing I wrote to him, I said, well, no, I don't have a suggestion. However, you could create an Apple script that does, tell application finder, mount volume, and then, the path to the volume, and tell, right? And then you have that run every 5 minutes or something. You use like CronX or Cronit or something to set it to run every 5 minutes. And Steve did this. Steve went and built this Apple script and he ran it. The problem was it was mounting a new volume every time. So instead of, let's say the volume is called videos, right? So it would be in /volume/videos. Then after 5 minutes, he would have /volume/videos and /volume/videos-1. And then after 10 minutes, /volume/videos-2, etc. So the next thing to try, I told him, was, see if you can figure out, and I didn't know the Apple script to figure this out directly, but you could do a terminal command to sense whether /volume/videos was there. And if it wasn't, then do the mount. Otherwise, skip that. And, every 5 minutes, he's good to go. So he was off on that path. And I think he's in the midst of that now. But, John, you got something else here?
And I think I solved part of the problem. But there's part of this that I know you're going to love. So anyways, I decided Apple script's cool and everything. Let me see if Automator can do this.
Right.
So I fired up Automator and I built something to do this. And I'll go over very briefly what I did. Now, this only seems to work. Well, no, I think this will work on both Leopard and Snow Leopard. So I went into Automator. The first thing when you start up Automator is it says, what would you like to do? Would you like to build a workflow? Blah, blah, blah.
Sure.
There's a bunch of things. For my testing, so I think what he really wants to do is to build an application to do this. But for my testing, I did an iCal alarm because I know how much you love iCal, Dave. And this worked. Check this out. But then I'm going to back you up on a deficiency in iCal.
Okay.
So I'm like, in order for me to test this quickly and just to fool around with iCal, let me define this as an iCal alarm.
Right. Sure.
So once I did that, so once you define the type of workflow, you then select from all the choices of things available in the library section of Automator. And everything that you need here is in the files and folders subcategory under library.
Okay.
And the first one is get specified servers. And what you do there is that particular action asks you for a path to the server. Now, when you select one, there's one thing I had to do is that if you have multiple mount points on your server, it's only going to do something like AFP:\10.blah blah blah. You'll have to type in /, in the name of the share if you have more than one share.
Because
otherwise, a dialogue will come up saying, like, for example, I have like 6 shares on my G5.
Okay.
And so it came up and said, well, which one of these? So I typed in, you know, the IP address slash, you know, John Braun, for example.
Right.
Then the other part is that when it asked for the username and password, and then the next action was connect to servers. So there are two actions that I defined: get specified servers and connect to servers. What happens then is, so then I made an iCal alarm out of that. And then what it does is it actually creates a new category in iCal.
Yeah.
And puts a little event there. And what happens is when the event comes up, rather than giving you, you know, a little dialog box and making a little beep sound, it'll run this automator action, which I thought was freaking cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Here's
it's bad news. It's like a poor man's cron.
Yes. Here's the bad news. And then I'm like, oh, you know what? Let me see if I can get this to run every 5 minutes. And here's the part where I agree with you. iCal sucks. The lowest resolution you can do on running something, I think, is once per day. I don't even think you can do it once per hour.
Wow.
An event can only come up once per day, once per week, once per month. And I've seen a lot of people howling about this in various iCal forums because I'm like, you got kidding me. I'm like, can't I say, like, you know, 0.1 of a day or whatever to be kind of clever? And it's like, nope. We can only make an event recur at a minimum once a day. Now, if anybody knows a way to refine that, that'd be great. I mean, I even hacked around and able to debug menu in iCal to see if there's a way to change this. Because then to me, this would actually work. And then here's the other cool part of this. So then once the volume was mounted and it gets around this problem, Dave, I thought, well, gosh, I'm probably going to run into the same problem that I've heard about before, is if you have a volume mounted and it's already there, it's going to say, well, I better make a volume -2, -3, -4 ad infinitum.
Right.
It didn't do that. When I set this up again with the volume already mounted, I saw something bounce in the dock, bounce, and it went away. And I looked in the slash volumes directory and there was not a -2. So it's smart enough. At least the automator action is smart enough not to create another instance and get you into that whole unpleasant situation.
Perfect. So Steve's answer here, unless he's figured it out with AppleScript, which of course is totally doable because automator is like this, you know, granddaddy thing that, you know, runs on top of that. But, is to create exactly the same automator action. Maybe you could be nice enough and email what you made to him. And then use Chronix, right? Which is a GUI, a Mac OS X, you know, GUI front end to the Unix cron utility, which allows you to schedule things, I believe, down to the minute. You can't do it any more frequently than once per minute, but that's plenty. So, you know, you could set it to do it every 5 minutes, and then it just runs this little automator application, and you're good
to
go.
Exactly. Yeah, he would not want to do iCal. I thought it was kind of clever, but iCal, again, I agree with you, it's lacking. But if he makes an application, as long as this utility can launch a application every 5 minutes, it should work great.
All right, so wait a minute. I'm realizing something here. You know, you've created this. Earlier this week, we had someone, and I can't remember his name, Finbar, created an Apple script. We've got to have a Mac Geekab file repository. And maybe drop.io is the answer. I've heard other podcasters check this out, so I'm going to ask you to check that out, John, and see what you think. But I think we got to find something because there's all these files that we all want to share here, and there's got to be some way of doing it because I think it would be great.
Or a public Dropbox or something? I don't know.
I think that's what drop.io does. I think it's essentially a public Dropbox sort of thing. Yeah. Yeah. So we got to figure this out because what I hate is, you know, hearing you mention this and then thinking, I want to be able to share that with the listeners and not saying that because we don't have some easy way to do so. And it's like, we got to upload it to the FTP server and then it's got to sync to the cache fly and this. And that's great for the audio and the big, big files. But, you know, there's got to be something out there where we can have this repository for all this.
Well,
stuff
in the meantime, everybody who has Dropbox gets a public Dropbox folder, which can be read only. So I think in the interim, I'll toss it there.
Okay, cool.
And I should be able to, we should be able to link to that.
Yeah, you can link to that. Yep. Cool. All right, awesome.
So that was a lot of fun though, because I really haven't, you know, I got a little extra time on my hands these days. I was like, you know, let me learn some automator, and I was really kind of impressed at how easy it made the whole operation.
It's great, man.
And I actually just used Automator the other day. Another thing, I'm sorry, tangents, but
that's
it's part of what we do.
Yeah.
So I've also been doing some more, you know, work with various web pages that I do, you know, with the pictures that I like to take and share. And I wanted to apply Google Analytics which is pretty cool. I don't know if you're using that at
all. Yeah, it's one of the things we have running over at TMO. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really nice. And I think a lot of people use it, and it basically is a free thing from Google. You embed some JavaScript in your web page, and then they tell you all sorts of statistics without identifying, as far as I can see, anybody specifically, but it gives you aggregated things like here's where people are coming from, here's pages they visited, and here's how long they stayed on the site, and just really useful things, I think, to fine-tune, or find problems with your website. The problem is I use iWeb now because I really like the iWeb and iPhoto integration. But the problem is iWeb isn't very friendly in that it whacks some things.
Okay.
Like, for example, it gives you the ability to embed HTML in your page, but this isn't quite good enough. Google Analytics wants that code embedded in there directly.
Yeah, yeah, it needs it so that the client can run a JavaScript that gives it all that information.
So iWeb is lacking in that you can put HTML snippets, which allows you to put in things like AdSense and Google Search and stuff, but not analytics.
Oh, interesting.
And even if you put the code in there afterwards, you edit the HTML file directly, the next time iWeb, you go to publish, it's like, I don't know what this is. I'm just going to erase it. So it's kind of unfriendly in that respect.
Nice.
But somebody wrote something. I don't have the name of it, but I'll link to it in the show notes. But it's basically an automator action that will take the JavaScript and you include like a campaign ID or something. And it basically rips through your iWeb folder and basically takes all your HTML and puts this where it should be. And it does it very, very quickly. There's some standalone apps that do this, but this does it very, very quickly. And it's an automator either application or service you can put in the service menu, depending on how you want to do it. So I'm digging Automator more and more, the more that I see people leverage it.
It's awesome. It's awesome. In fact, I have something with our Automator scripts that I need to figure out. So maybe I'll run that by you and you come up with a magic little answer for us.
Yeah, I'll give you a good, I'll give you a discount.
Good rates. That's awesome.
Well, actually, in exchange for the horrible advice, this one will be free in exchange for the horrible advice I gave you in the past.
Yes, that's right. That's right. We're
not going to talk about that now, but
no, we're not.
You're on the case.
We're on the case. Yeah,
the audio case.
We're slowly moving down the path. It is, though we've had a couple of glitches this show, it believe it or not, it is better. And I have an idea, but we'll leave it at that. Last question for the show. Stefan writes, I'm currently thinking about getting a new iMac. Since I currently use an SSD internally in my Mac Mini, I'm thinking about how to get the best performance, hard disk-wise, out of the iMac. I do not want to open up the iMac myself, so my idea is put the SSD into an external enclosure and connect it via FireWire 800. The question is, will FireWire 800 be so slow that it won't see any difference between the SSD and the iMac's internal drive? Okay, I can talk about this because I've done this. Last summer when we did the SSD obsession, I got the SSD drive from Runcore, but there's many vendors out there now. And the first thing, I didn't want to open up my MacBook Pro, just like you don't want to open up your iMac. Eventually, I did open my MacBook Pro because the whole portability thing trumped my desire to leave my hands out of my computer. So as you might remember, I ran on USB initially. So this was USB. So, half the speed of your FireWire 800, essentially. And I instantly noticed the speed difference from SSD in terms of the near zero latency, or in other words, the way a hard drive works is you've got a bunch of platters spinning around, and then you've got like the drive head. It's kind of like an old record player, for those of us that remember old record players, where you've got a needle and the record spinning around. But the difference is in a hard drive, the needle jumps all over the place, right? So if you've got, let's say you've got a file that's 10 blocks in size. Well, all 10 of those blocks don't have to be right next to each other. You might have two in one spot and then, four in another, and then, three in another and one somewhere else. And so the drive, the needle or the head has to jump all over the place. And that's called latency. That when you're talking about hard drives, it's the seek time. How long does it take to get to wherever it is that I can then begin reading the data that you've requested? And that can be not insignificant, especially for some reason in laptop drives where it's just terrible. Regardless of the speed of the drive, we're talking about what it takes to get to the point where you're going to start reading data, not the reading or writing of the data itself. So SSD, there is no platter spinning. There is no needle. There is no drive head. It's just essentially RAM. And you go to the drive and you say, get me this data. And it says, sure, here it is. And get me that data. Sure, here it is. And it's not quite no latency, but it's minimal, very, very minimal. So you see that regardless of the interface, right? Be it USB, eSATA, FireWire, you know, IDE, it doesn't matter. You're going to get that benefit because that's happening inside the drive. Mm-hmm. Now, most SSD drives nowadays are going to be able to transfer data. You know, some of them, it's, you know, 100 megabytes a second, right? Megabytes a second. Am I getting that right? Yeah. Well, and then up to.
I have more data on that.
Okay. But up to, you know, some of them are doing over 200, right? And my Runcore drive is one of those. Now, that's where you will not see the full speed benefit of your drive, because FireWire 800 is essentially going to do about 80 megabytes a second. And I'm rounding very, very, you know, grossly here, but essentially that's what you get out of USB. You got about 40. But that may not matter to you. I have to say, when I moved my Runcore drive from USB, which was essentially 40, to inside my Mac, which then let it do about 140, because my FireWire, my eSATA interface in the Mac is only, you know, 1.5 gigabit throughput or whatever. It got better. It didn't. I tested the speeds and, you know, it showed, yes, you're transferring data much faster, but I noticed no user level speed benefit when my experience, my user experience did not change in a speed fashion when I moved the drive inside the computer. I noticed no difference. The biggest difference I noticed was moving from the mechanical hard drive to the solid state hard drive, and it didn't matter how it was connected. I'm not doing huge data transfers, though. If you are, then you may notice that SSD is faster. And that's why a lot of the, you know, HD video people and all that are going to these SSD RAID units where they're just getting this ridiculous throughput on eSATA that you just can't get out of mechanical hard drives. But as long as that's not your goal, then I think on your FireWire 800, you're going to see it's going to be great. I think you're going to be fine. So, John, you've got something to add here.
I got something to add. So you're absolutely right. I did some calculations and actually used Google to do some of these translations. So the thing is, you will run into a limitation with FireWire 800 before you run into a limitation of the drive performance. Well, a few comments. So one, right, FireWire 800 is 800 megabits per second, which is 100 megabytes per second.
Okay.
Now, if you're talking a drive, and I looked at Tom's Hardware, I have a fairly recent article, and right now I think the state of the art, at least affordable, that aren't like these huge, you know, fiber channel arrays, because I saw some that advertised 1,000. Like, let's talk about drives that humans can afford here. The best one I think right now is one of the Intel higher end ones. And yeah, you're absolutely right, Dave. About 200 megabytes per second is the theoretical maximum throughput if you're talking, I think, the ideal operation, which is a sequential read.
Well, right? Because
they're different operations, or at least the way that they qualify the performance of the drive is depending on the operation you're doing. And I think the best performance you get is when you're doing, let me see what this blue bar means. Yeah, I think it's sequential read.
All right, and check, you know, I know that the OWC drives from Otherworld Computing are spec'd out faster than 200 megabytes a second. So if speed is your thing, go check those out too, because I think they're about 240 is where they clock in.
Because even at least the chip, so you and I both have the same MacBook. The chip that we have in there is called an ICH8-M AHCI. Yeah. And as you pointed out, it's a 1.5 gigabit per second chip, which comes out to 192 megabytes per second.
Right.
So even that could potentially be a limiting factor, because then you're starting to reach the theoretical maximum of the drive. Now, I guess what I'm saying is that I don't think you're going to see sustained 200 megabytes per second operation out of this drive
all the time. Got it.
You may, again, I think mostly with a read operation on a big contiguous file.
Yeah, well, take contiguous out of this.
Or not contiguous,
right?
a single file.
That's right. One sustained read as opposed to
you're right. Latency doesn't matter. So if you're reading a big whopping multi-gigabyte file, you're probably going to approach the theoretical maximum of the drive. Now, the thing is, and I've heard people howling about this, the thing is there's different flavors of SATA. SATA 1 is supposed to be, which is the interface inside of the Mac, Serial right. TA. SATA 1 is 1.5 gigabytes per second, or gigabits.
Yes.
SATA 2 is 3.0 gigabits, and then SATA 3 is 6.0 gigabits. Now, I've heard people comment that I think Apple, for whatever reason, kind of crippled the chip in our machine where it could do 3, but it could... I know I've seen some commentary where people were upset that it was 1.5 when they felt it should not be. It should have been able to do 3.
And they did that with newer MacBook Pros, too, and then offered a firmware update that bumped it up to 3, but you and I were left out in the cold, John. We're stuck at 1.5. And like you said, it's... It you know, it's almost inconsequential. You know, without the SATA drives, it is inconsequential.
But to me, the interesting thing is that in the past, typically from what I've seen, the bus speed, be it SATA or ATA or parallel ATA, now that we're calling it that because now they're serial.
Right.
The bus speed would always far exceed, maybe not by an order of magnitude because they love orders of magnitude, but it would far exceed the speed of the drive. Now you're getting to the point where the speed of the bus and the speed of the drive are starting to approach each other.
Yeah, that's
which
right.
Which is, I think, very unusual. It's something that I think a lot of people didn't expect.
Well,
so,
and it used to be... used to be that, you know, certainly with FireWire 800, but even FireWire 400 was faster than, you know, 99% of the hard drives that any consumer would ever buy, right? I mean, you know, you could go buy some FireWire 800 drive and... But the thing was, it was like, well, but if the drive is going to do like 30 megabytes a second, well, you know, what do I care? You know, great, I've got all this room on the bus, but who cares? But you're right. Now it's an issue.
So I think what we're going to see is that now, fortunately, SATA 2 and SATA 3 are in the wings with the 3 and the 6 gigabit per second throughput. And I think that's going to, for the time being, stay ahead of at least the throughput of a, you know, single consumer level, you know, somewhat affordable SSD.
Right. Until you go, you know, some multi-channel array where you've got multiple drives, and that's where
I did a search, and I was shocked because I saw this is for enterprise deployment, but I saw some, you know, SSD arrays that were in the thousands of megabytes per second.
Oh, yeah.
Like, wait a second, did I read that right? And it's like, yes.
Yeah.
And you, it's almost like fiber channel. It's when you get all these drives going through a really fast bus.
Right.
And they're all operating in tandem, maybe with some sort of RAID or something like that. Yeah, you could be talking high speeds. And when you're in an enterprise, you need that.
Well, it's really what they're using them for is video, HD video, nonlinear editing and that sort of thing. They'll rent out units that have these so that you can do all your editing and then, you know, you don't have to buy it. And then you just return the unit once you're done with your deal. So. All right. Where are we? Oh, you said that was the last question. So I think that's the time to bring in the band.
Hi, band.
Cool. Dude, you rocked at this show.
I was doing my homework, man.
I know. It shows. It's awesome.
I think I hit it out of the park. I don't know if I hit it out of the park. But,
I think you did. All right, what do you folks think? You think John hit it out of the park? I do. I think so. This is good. We should. I know you're all premium subscribers, and I know you know how to find us, but we're going to say it anyway.
We like saying it.
What's that? We'll say
it. I like
it.
Saying it.
206-666-GEEK is the number. 4335. Yes, John, I beat you to it, but the email address is...
feedback@macgeekab.com, Dave.
That's feedback@macgeekab.com.
But if you're listening to this, you probably want to use...
Premium. That's right. Yes. In fact, please do. It really does help us, you know, segregate the questions and know. And we can, you know, between us here, we answer your questions first if we're going through the email. So, you know, hey, it is what it is. It's a little bit extra that we can still do. So we do it.
Because you're special. Just don't tell the other people.
That's right. iPhone Alley. Michael Johnston's home. That's where he spends his days. When he's not converting this podcast to AAC for us and all of you. And CacheFly, CacheFly.com, provides all the bandwidth to get this podcast to you. And that's it. We're out of here, John. Let's do it.
All right. It's still daylight. Excellent.
Still daylight. I got to drive to Boston tonight.
Really?
Yeah, I got to
be careful.
Thanks.
It could be snowy.
I know.
Well, I don't know. No, I hear this tonight, tomorrow.
Who knows? Be careful, be safe, have fun, and don't get caught.
made up.